The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available. Our goal, to empower you and put you in charge of your case. I'm your host, Attorney Noah Davis, broadcasting from the studios of Clay 1180 AM in Tacoma, Lakewood, Washington. Be sure to check out our website at www.noahyourrights.com as we post the audio for each show as well as follow-up information on each program. And you can always visit clay1180.com for more information on me, this show, and additional programming on your conversation station, which, by the way, not only can you listen to through the radio, but you can also stream via the website clay1180.com. This is episode 23 of Noah Your Rights. We're continuing our theme on employment law, and today we're going to tackle the Equal Pay Opportunity Act, wage disputes, and the difference between independent contractors and employees. Okay, so you might be thinking, you might be sitting at home, you might be driving your car home from work or on a trip. You might have been browsing through the stations and you just heard me say, yeah, we're going to talk about independent contractors versus employees. And you're thinking, well, that's not the sexiest of topics, is it? But you know what? It's an important one and one that comes up over and over. And those of you that have businesses or have worked for small businesses might have run into this issue from time to time. As an employer, we all want to hire independent contractors, don't we? But why is that? Well, you know, there's a number of reasons. For starters, not having to pay an additional tax of approximately 10% of the wages that you pay your workers, so an additional 10% of the wages that you already pay your workers for items such as a share of Social Security, Medicare, workers' compensation coverage, and unemployment insurance. It also means that you don't have to hire a payroll company. You know, that can be really expensive too. You don't have to withhold income taxes for employees, which can get you in a lot of trouble. A lot of companies do this withholding, and you're holding that money in trust for the federal government, and then they spend it because they get into a crunch, and they can get hit with steep fines or worse. There can be potentially some criminal penalties there too. You also don't have to, if you don't have employees, you don't have to timely file federal and state informational reports. Those of us that do those on our own know that that can be a real time suck at the end of the quarter when you're filing those. And you kind of dread doing that. You got to make sure that you do it on time or you get penalized for not filing on time. And then you also have to pay taxes. If you don't pay the taxes weekly, monthly, or quarterly, you can face steep fines, not just from the state, but even steeper fines from the federal government. And when you try to get out of those with either state-wise or federal-wise, it's almost impossible. It takes a long time and a lot of effort to try to get those fines reduced. So there's a lot of obligations on you as an employer if you have an employee. With an independent contractor, it's a different situation. In fact, also, there's another reason outside of the tax reasons and the filings, the administrative sort of background. There's another reason why having someone classified as an independent contractor over an employee might be extremely beneficial. And that's because, and although this is not complete, but there is a disconnect between the laws designed to protect employees like discrimination, harassment, wrongful termination, and those that exist between two contracting parties, like two companies that enter into a contract to perform some type of work. You're not going to have that same servient, i.e. employment relationship that the law is based on, where it tries to help the employee against an employer that might have a stronger bargaining position. So what about when you, let's talk about some situations, because I think that when you run through some examples, it gives you a better idea of independent contractor versus employee. It helps us shed some light on this really often a gray area. So how about when you hire a lawyer? So you're going to hire me, Noah Davis, attorney at law. Noah, I want to hire you. Am I going to be your employee or independent contractor? Well, your lawyer is not your employee unless that lawyer only works for you, like in-house at your company or remotely. Still in-house, but remotely only for that particular company. and you control the lawyer's duties and tasks. So that lawyer is paid a salary, just paid by you. It's not an hourly rate. It's not a per matter rate. It's to advise your company. 95% of the time, maybe it's even greater, 99% of the time, the lawyer has many other clients and is truly an independent contractor, not your employee. You're just hiring them to perform a service for you, and you're not directing exactly the manner or methods of that particular lawyer. How about when lawyers hire court reporters for depositions? Well, court reporters, they have their own business. They have their business of court reporting. They're definitely not employees of the lawyers. And that remains the case even if we hire them over and over again, which we often do. We hire the same ones, but it still doesn't make them our employee. They're employed by the court reporting agency. They're also hired out every day by other lawyers. And the lawyers don't control their product. We don't control their hours, except they do have to be present during our deposition. So there is some control there, and you're going to find as we go through this discussion, and we're going to bring on representatives from the Department of Labor Industry soon, we're going to go through some of these examples and talk about some of these gray areas. There's always the gray area, and it's hard in the law to have very clear rules sometimes because there's often a lot of gray areas. Well, what about you and your house? So enough of this lawyer stuff. What about you and your house? When you hire a painter or a general contractor for work around your house, is that person your employee or are they an independent contractor? Well, in nearly every case, you're hiring an independent contractor. While you direct the work to be done, and L&I, they may call that the output or the result. That might be their terminology. But the work to be done, you're not controlling. You're giving them a project to do, but you're not controlling necessarily their hours or exactly how that work is being done. You just want the finished product. That's what you're really buying. It's the finished product. Paint my house. I want my house to be white. It's blue right now, or vice versa. I want it to be blue. It's white. But you're not out there saying, this is how you use the stroke here. These are the lines. This is how you put up your tape. This is how the scaffolding is supposed to look. You're not out there doing all that. Also, what you need is that person that you're hiring to be engaged in that type of business continuously. You're not hiring someone like the neighbor, for example, to come over and paint your house who normally isn't engaged in that type of business. If you hire your neighbor once off to come over to your house, you might be crossing that line into an employee where you're directing what they do and they're not engaged in that particular line of business. Also, the contractor you're hiring for your house, they should have their own EIN. You probably heard that. Employment Identification Number. They also should have a state UBI, Unified Business Identifier Number. And they should also be reporting and paying excise taxes and filing federal tax returns. And we're going to get into that a little bit more, too. You're going to find out, too, that, boy, there is a lot of litigation in this area. And that's partly because employees can hire lawyers since the failure to pay wage statute in Washington provides a remedy of double the missing wages plus attorney fees, meaning the lawyer will most likely take your case on a contingency, contingent on there being a recovery. Another way to get your missing wages you allege weren't paid is through the Washington Department of Labor and Industries. And L&I, short for Labor and Industries, can make a determination as to whether or not the person you hired is your employee or not. So joining us today from the Washington Department of Labor and Industries are going to be two representatives. And just after the break, we're going to ask them these difficult questions about employer versus independent contractor status. We're going to talk to them about wage disputes and how they go about determining those and enforcing those. And there's a new law in the state of Washington, the Equal Pay Opportunity Act. And we're going to ask them what that's all about. So stay tuned and we'll have L&I joining us right after the break.
To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack! You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal!
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley? Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold!
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
You accidentally cut your daughter's bangs unevenly. Do you A, line things up a centimeter from her hairline?
Man, oh man.
No, sweatbands are so hot right now. Everyone's wearing them, like that basketball player and that other basketball player.
B, get spiritual.
Mom, where did all the mirrors go?
A reflection could never capture our true selves.
Huh?
Beauty is within.
C, look on the bright side.
Less time blow drying, more time texting.
Or D, show empathy.
Mom, you really don't have
Ta-da! Twinsies!
I kinda love it. As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping you, the listener, be educated about your legal rights and resources that can be available to you. Make sure you check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com, or send me an email at noah@noahyourrights.com. Let me know what topics interest you and how we can help you out, and what type of information that we need to provide you that so that you could be successful in your case. Today, we're talking about employment law. We've been talking about that for a few weeks. We're continuing that theme. It's a very broad theme, and we're not going to be able to tackle nearly every employment law issue. But today, we're tackling a very important one, and that's the distinguishing between an independent contractor and an employee. We're also talking Equal Pay Opportunity Act, which is a new law that Washington State passed. And we're going to talk a little bit about wage disputes and how you, if you have a wage dispute, how you can have your rights enforced and get some help along the way. Joining me today from the Department of Washington Labor and Industries is Ellen Saline from the Employment Standards Program and Dave Johnson, who's a program manager at the Department of Labor and Industries. Welcome, Ellen and Dave.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Can we talk a little bit broadly about what Washington L&I does and the different roles that it plays?
Yeah, L&I is kind of a little bit of everything to everybody. It's a pretty big program, almost 3,000 employees, and we're everything from one of, if not the largest insurance companies in the state, deals with workers' comp insurance. We also have a safety division that is kind of like a state division of OSHA, and then several different smaller compliance units like electrical, contractor registration, boilers, plumbers, and we're one of those programs, and our program specifically deals with employment law issues, mostly wage and hours.
I think most people, and I'm going to fall in this category of most people, traditionally think of labor and industries as the industrial insurance component of the Washington state government. And I think people are unfamiliar at the different roles and different hats that L&I plays, because it's actually quite broad, and you've mentioned some of these. The topics that we're tackling today are some of those areas that I think people aren't necessarily familiar with, unless they get a letter from your agency letting them know that there might be a problem with how they're categorizing their employees. But otherwise, a lot of people don't realize how broad a role and how big L&I, you know, really is in terms of enforcement and looking after employee rights. So there's a lot that you described, Dave, and I want to focus and narrow us down to three issues today. One is going to be independent contractors versus employees, talking about the differences there. The second is wage disputes. And the third is the Equal Pay Opportunity Act. And I suppose that we should start there with the last topic, and that's the Equal Pay Opportunity Act. And I believe, Ellen, that's sort of your realm. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how this came to be? What is the Equal Pay Opportunity Act? And is it has it already started as a law in the state of Washington?
Sure, absolutely. The Equal Pay Opportunity Act is a new law that passed during the 2018 legislative session, and it went into effect on June 7th. So it is up and running. We've already started receiving complaints. And the Equal Pay Opportunity Act does a few things. It makes it so that employers are required to provide equal pay and career advancement opportunities to employees regardless of gender. And so it means that employers must provide equal compensation to similarly employed workers. And what that really means is employees who work for the same employer, who have similar working conditions, skills, effort, and responsibility. So that similarly employed doesn't necessarily just mean they have the same job title. It's really protecting people who are doing the same level of work and making sure that they're getting compensated equitably.
Because I guess that's one way that traditionally employers could pay women less was to give someone a title of director or manager and yet have two people doing the same job, just one without the title, and the person that didn't have the title just would happen to be a woman and would get paid less.
Absolutely. Yep. That's one of the things that this law is aiming to combat, which is just to be able to evaluate the employee's job duties, not just the job title, to make sure that they are receiving that equitable compensation regardless of gender.
So I, you know, on the way over here today to today's show, I was thinking about this topic that I know not a lot about, and because it's such a new law too, and it's going to be developing, there's no case law on it yet. There's going to be, of course, these gray areas. And one gray area I was thinking about, and this is going to be probably a terrible example, and this is partly because I haven't put a lot of thought into it yet, but you take the WNBA and those professional basketball players from the women's league, and you compare it to the basketball players from the men's league. If they're, let's just say they're owned, I don't know if the NBA owns the WNBA or not, but what do you do when you've got basketball players, men, making, they're doing the same thing, they're making $5 million a year or more, and you have these women, these female basketball players, and they're making like $100,000. And if you think about that example, and maybe you'll recall the women's soccer team, the national team, they raised that issue too, saying, how come the men are getting paid X amount and we're getting paid a fraction of that?
Yeah, that's a great point. To be honest, with that, those specific examples, I'm not sure if the WNBA and the NBA players are employed by the same organization, the same employer. So what I can say to that is that there are instances where men and women or people of whatever gender may be can be paid differently when they're doing similar work. And some of those factors include there can be a differential in pay based on education, training, or experience. Seniority, merit, or measuring earnings by production, quantity, or quality, as well as regional differences. So there are different acceptable reasons for gender pay differentials. This law makes it illegal to have it be based, that differential be based on gender specifically.
Well, also on the way over here, I was listening to an unnamed radio station that had a report on there where I believe maybe the University of Washington had done this report and or this study, and it showed that persons with college degrees ended up, of course, as you would imagine, earning more over their lifetime than persons without a college degree. But according to the report, as you probably can imagine too, women made less than men. So same college degree, same background, but historically they've made less than men. So this law is geared to addressing this historical disparity. That's the reason for it, right? So how are people going to make complaints? How are they going? Is it going to be individual employees saying, I'm not making as much as Bob. I've worked here for 10 years. Bob's worked here for 10. I should be getting paid what he's paid. And how is this how are the complaints going to be processed by LNI, and then how are you going to enforce this?
Yep, absolutely. So the complaints are filed by individual workers. You can find a complaint form on our website, which is www.lni.wa.gov/equalpay. There's also some good resources there, like a fact sheet that go into some more details about the law. But that's where you can find a complaint form, or you can go to your local LNI office and get a complaint form there as well. And then that's where you will be telling us what rights you feel were violated under that law. And then it'll be up to an agent like myself to receive that complaint and contact the employer and the employee making the complaint to gather information from both sides to make a determination whether we believe that there is a violation of unequal pay based on gender.
Does it make any difference if the business has 100 employees or two?
Not under this law, no. There's not a minimum requirement of employees.
It's going to be tough for small businesses. I mean, they're going to really have to examine their current workforce. I mean, this is going to be, it's going to send some shockwaves, across the workforce because, and I've already sent out some emails to some of the employers and some of the companies that I represent saying, you guys really need to sit down and examine how you pay your employees and whether or not there's a gap based on gender, whether there's a disparity there. But I imagine, that this is going to take some time to implement from the employer side of things?
That certainly could be the case. At this point, we really are focusing on trying to educate the public. Like I said, our website has more resources both for employees and employers. So employees know their rights as well as employers can find out, what they're mandated to do as well. I should mention also during this discussion that the law doesn't just have to do with pay. So there's also within the Equal Pay Opportunity Act, there are provisions in there that protect an employee's right to engage in wage discussions. So previously there haven't been any protections for employees who would like to discuss their wages with coworkers. This law does protect those rights. So employers cannot
have a seal, like some confidentiality agreement that they make all their employees
exactly,
sign.
Exactly, thank you. Exactly. They can't discourage employees from engaging in wage discussions. They also can't retaliate against an employee for asking for the reason for their wages or lack of opportunities and advancement.
I wonder how, and again, I'm just sort of thinking out loud, but I wonder how the Federal Arbitration Act is going to come into play on this, because a lot of employees have arbitration provisions with their employer, and any dispute concerning their employment has to go to arbitration. And I know this is a state law. I just wonder the interplay of the Federal Arbitration Act and how that's going to work itself out, because if there's a dispute over what someone's being made, the contract's going to say, we got to take it to arbitration because maybe there's some reasons why you're not being paid what you are. So I don't know if you've had any discussion in-house about that at all.
That's a great point. And like you say, this is a brand new law. And, a lot of these discussions will, be continuing to happen. And I don't have a specific answer on that at this time of how that will play out.
Speaking of this being a brand new law, the Governor Inslee's office issued a public media statement, notice saying June 7th, this law went into effect. So I went over to the RCWs and I tried to find it and I couldn't pull it up. So how has it been implemented, or is it in effect, and has it been codified in the revised Code of Washington?
It is in effect. Like you said, it went into effect on June 7th, but it has not been codified by the Code Revisor's Office yet, so there's not an RCW on the website there to reference at this point, but the law itself has taken effect, so the verbiage that was passed in the legislature is what is law, and the Code Revisor's Office is in the process of preparing that, and the last information I received from their office is that they're hoping to have that up on their website sometime this summer, hopefully by mid-July or so is what we're hoping for.
Well, stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and we've got more coming up with the Department of Labor Industries on NOAA, Your Rights.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack! You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal!
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley? Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold.
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from NOAA Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Some statistics are surprising, some are unbelievable, and some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%, and that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay 1180 AM. We're talking employment law. We're talking independent contractors. We're talking the Equal Pay Opportunity Act. Joining us on the phone today, we have Ellen Saline of Washington LNI and also Dave Johnson. Dave, I've kind of left you alone so far. I haven't picked on you too much, but I want to turn my attention over to you and ask you a few questions about wage disputes and this distinction between independent contractors and employees. Let's talk with the wage disputes. You know, in the introduction, I said that LNI, traditionally, many of us just think that that's workers' compensation insurance regime. And that's all LNI does, but it does a lot more. One thing it does, and I can't say I'm that familiar with it, but I'm becoming more familiar. I am handling a case involving this sort of area now, but LNI does do wage disputes. So can you walk us through maybe the statutory authority, or if not the statutory authority, at least the background of how people file claims and get your office involved in a wage dispute?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I find it interesting you use the word wage dispute. A lot of times when we're talking to folks in this area, we hear a pretty loaded term that's called wage theft. What we do here at LNI is we refer to them as wage complaints because we're an independent arbiter. But basically, it's when someone's claiming they weren't paid what they should have been paid. Just so that you know, we receive about 6,000 wage complaints a year from Washington employees, which sounds like a pretty big number until you consider there's over 3 million employees in the state of Washington. So I think we'd say most employers do the right thing. But basically what it is, it's people who says they haven't been paid either their final paycheck, they haven't been paid the minimum wage. We deal with deductions, whether the deductions taken out of the paycheck were authorized or not. And we also deal with agreed wage issues. So and we enforce... We actually have enforcement power over some of the minimum wage ordinances around the state, but it starts out with somebody filing a complaint with us. We deal with it as a one-on-one individual complaint, and they can either get those forms, they can file online through our website, or they can fill out one of our complaint forms and mail it in or bring it into one of our offices, and then we have about 22 agents around the state that investigate those.
And there's some different jurisdictions of different parties here. There's a there's also the Federal Department of Labor that's out there. There's city organizations. The city of Tacoma has a wage dispute department or division or wing. How does the state L&I work with those different entities? And sometimes are they all involved in a particular case?
So the answer to your last question first, sometimes yes. But usually we have a very good working relationship with our different partners. And part of that is we have different memorandums of understanding where we understand where our interests lie. So, for instance, people who are complaining about the Seattle minimum wage would most likely be filing a complaint with their department. The same goes for Tacoma. SeaTac has a minimum wage, but they don't have enforcement there. So it's either a lawsuit or we get involved. And then we also, the federal government, as you pointed out, has a lot of crossover with our state laws. And so we work very closely with them. Most of their investigations are more what we refer to as like a company-wide, where they'll hear there's a problem happen and they'll focus on a particular company. Whereas ours are more one-on-one. The actual employee files a complaint and we investigate.
And when a complaint is filed online and L&I gets involved, what's that process look like? Is there an informal meeting? You do an investigation? And then depending on the outcome, there's an administrative appeal process. Is that roughly, and maybe I didn't do a good job probably summarizing that, but can you take us through a little bit about that procedure, that process?
Sure. And one of the things I'll point out, you were talking about statutory authority. And although there's several wage laws that come into play, like the Minimum Wage Act and the Agreed Wage Law, the one that really changed things here in the state of Washington was the Wage Payment Act, which was passed in 2006, I'm sorry. But the Wage Payment Act is what gave us the administrative authority to enforce these. And so what that means is our investigation starts with an agent dealing with the parties, usually with the employee first. Once they get enough information where they feel there's a prima facie case, then they'll go to the employer. And we give everybody an opportunity to give us their side of the story, to produce whatever records they have to prove or disprove what the claims are. And then in the end, we make a decision. And if we decide that the employer has not violated the law or there's not enough evidence, we issue what we call a determination of compliance. That's also appealable, but it's basically we're saying that we have determined they've complied with the law. And then the other direction would be what we call a notice of assessment and citation, which means we're actually assessing the wages owed, interest at 12% per year, and then penalties as well if it's a willful violation.
As you mentioned, I mean, the law passing in 2006 is a game changer. Because before that, if someone wasn't paid their wages and so they have a failure to pay wage claim, they'd have to go see a lawyer. And maybe they didn't know a lawyer. Maybe they didn't know who did those types of cases. Maybe they couldn't get someone to take their case if there wasn't a lot of wages owed. I don't know all the circumstances of lawyers taking those cases, but the fact that you're stepping up and the Department of Labor and Industries has the statutory authority to take on these cases. And as you mentioned, 6,000 cases is not a small number. I mean, you're doing obviously big work to try to help in even the playing field of employees versus employers.
Oh, sure. And I mean, actually, before the Wage Payment Act, we did have what they refer to as de jure authority, which allowed us to stand in the shoes of the employees. But because that also involved a lawsuit, it happened very rarely because the resources it takes are pretty significant. So, yeah, you're correct. The Wage Payment Act really kind of changed the game for us. And we end up, since the Wage Payment Act, I think just last year alone, we recovered over $4 million in wages for employees.
Wow.
So that's a big deal from our standpoint.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. So one more question that I had about wage payments before I switch gears on you and turn over to independent contractors, and you kind of brought this up a little bit, and that was some cities in the state of Washington have the state of Washington has a higher minimum wage than the federal government does. So we set the bar higher. Second thing is individual cities have passed minimum wage acts that are higher than the state. If a particular city like SeaTac, Seattle, or Tacoma has a higher minimum wage than the state minimum wage, will you still enforce the difference if someone wasn't being paid the city-based minimum wage?
Well, let's put it this way. They usually enforce their own laws. As I told you, SeaTac doesn't. We also have a law that says that an employer must meet their obligation to pay either an agreed or an obligated wage by ordinance. And so because of that, for instance, in the city of SeaTac, we've enforced the city of SeaTac's minimum wage level because of that law that allows us to enforce their obligation to pay that required by ordinance. But whichever jurisdiction has the higher or the more favorable one is going to be the one that wins the day.
When we're talking about independent contractors in the state of Washington, I think this is your stated position, and by your, I mean the Department of Labor and Industries. When we're talking about the distinction between independent contractors and employees, is there a presumption in the state of Washington, and is that presumption towards the worker being an employee?
You know, I don't know if I'd say presumption. Usually when we get these, the presumption is we're dealing with an employee because they're filing a complaint. So the independent contractor usually comes up during our investigation when, as we're talking to the employer, their defense is, well, this person's not an employee, they're an independent contractor. And when they do that, we actually have a test that we use to kind of make that determination. We call it an economic realities test. I've seen earlier where you had mentioned there's other tests, and that's true. It seems like almost every agency that deals with this has one form of the test or another. But basically, this six-part test that we use, which is based in case law, looks at whether the worker is economically dependent on the person who they're doing the work for.
Yeah, I have said in the past, and it certainly is the case when I deal with these with individual instances of allegations of independent contractor versus employee, depending on which agency you're dealing with, there's a different test. There's an IRS test. There's the Washington Employment Security Department test. There's seemingly the statutory test, a common law test, and then an L&I test. And then beyond the test, you have all these examples. And the examples seem to really color in the components of the test and give us a lot more indication of which side a worker falls on, the independent contractor side or the employee side. If you could take us through, and we're not going to get through the whole test before the break, but if you could start taking us through the L&I test, I just want to give everyone an idea of the factors, and then maybe we can talk through some of the factors and some of the gray areas.
Sure, and you can cut me off when you need to, but we have a six-part test, and we look at six factors. So the first one is the degree of control that the business has over the worker. The second one is, what's the worker's opportunity for profit or loss dependent upon their managerial skill? The third one is the worker's investment in equipment or material. Fourth is the degree of skill required to do the job. Fifth is the degree of permanence of the working relationship. And then the last factor is the degree in which the services rendered by the worker are an integral part of the business.
So it seems that this test, a lot of it is based on the control factor. And I know that you've broken this down for us and you've done it succinctly, but if we can step back for a second and just talk about the control, are we talking about people that you direct or supervise? Is that the idea of control, or is there a definition for control?
No, and actually, I think what you'll see is almost all the tests have that control factor in it. That is a very important factor, because normally when you hire somebody as a contractor to do work for you, you usually give them money to do a job, but most people don't tell them how to do their job. I mean, when somebody comes in and lays carpet at my house, I don't tell them when to get there, when to leave, when they can take their breaks, how to install the carpet. So that control part is really important. When you treat them like employees, they look more like employees to us.
Well, And I understand that. I want to take that topic up a little bit more, and I want to give you some examples and run through those so that people can get a better idea of when control becomes so much control that it kind of converts the person over from an independent contractor to an employee. So stay with us. We're going to take a short break. We're talking employment law. We're talking independent contractors. You're listening to Know Your Rights on Clay 1180 AM.
Deal Talk. To make sure my new Spicy Chicken Club combo is a great value, I asked a sales expert.
It's amazing, Jack! You get a spicy, crispy chicken breast, hickory smoked bacon, and melted cheese on toasted sourdough, plus fries and a drink. All in one delicious deal!
You said it, Stanley.
Ow. Wait, what's happening?
Stanley? Stanley, you're deflating!
I'm so cold!
We need a doctor!
Jack, tell my wife I love her.
No! Try my new Spicy Chicken Club combo. Another great deal from Jack in the Box.
Hi, I'm Noah from Know Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.knowyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@knowyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
This week's episode, Rattlesnake at the Pond.
Oh, Johnny, skipping rocks at the pond sure is fun.
Hey, look, a moving stick.
That ain't a stick. That's a rattlesnake.
Sassy, we're in danger.
Good idea, Sassy. Go get Mr. Gunderson. You will in a second, but first you'd like to tell us something we may not know about animal shelters in the United States?
It's getting close, Sassy.
Approximately 8 million pets enter shelters each year? The majority of which are in shelters because of owner-related issues that the animals have no control over?
Sassy the rattlesnake! Save us, Sassy!
What, Sassy? You wish you were videotaping this? Sassy!
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you on your legal rights and resources available. You're listening to Clay 1180 AM. We're talking employment law, and we're focused right now on the distinction between independent contractors and employees. On the phone, I have Dave Johnson from the Washington Department of Labor and Industries, and we're talking about this 6-7 part test that L&I employs when it starts looking at and trying to make a determination between employees and independent contractors. Right before the break, we were talking about this notion of control and an employer, a potential employer controlling the worker that that they brought on to do a particular project. I think it might be helpful, Dave, if we talk about a couple scenarios. And the two that come to mind, there's actually three that come to mind, and I'll just name them, and then maybe we can go through these a little bit, and we can help break this down a little bit more for folks. Because I think this is really, and you probably find this too in your agency, this is an area that people really struggle with. I mean, they really, really do. And partly it's because a lot of businesses and a lot of small employers don't want to hire employees because it's a lot of paperwork, it's a lot of work, and there's liability attached to it. So the examples I want to have us focus on are number one, how about the contractor situation? So a homeowner hires a contractor to come over their home. So that's one. Number two is the janitor situation, because I know that's probably a biggie in your office, or historically it was. The janitors hiring other janitors to do the work at a particular office. And then a third area would be just a small business that hires an office worker, just one person to come in periodically and do some work for them at the office. So let's go back to the house, the homeowner. They're going to bring over a painter. What would you like to see if someone, a homeowner, is hiring a painter to paint their house?
Right. And if I could just start by saying, control at one time was considered the most important factor. There was a Supreme Court decision last year that said it's only one of six and it shouldn't take precedence. But when you're talking about bringing somebody over to do a job for you, And a painter is probably a very good example of someone who is very likely going to be an independent contractor, because they're asking somebody to come in and do a job that they themselves don't normally do as part of their business. So it would be different if a paint company was hiring a painter as an independent contractor. That would raise some eyebrows. But a homeowner is hiring a contractor to come do a job that they're not capable, or they don't feel they could do a good job. And so the person pretty much sets their hours, buys their own material, brings their own ladders. They take care of the paint job, and all the homeowner at the end wants to do is get a good job and pay the person.
In that scenario, and you're right, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I feel that same way, but maybe we start to blur things a little bit depending on what the facts are. So let's say that the person that's hired, this is the first time that they've painted a house. Maybe they don't have an EIN. Maybe they don't have a UBI. Maybe the paint that they're getting, the homeowner's buying, purchasing for them. Maybe the homeowner's out there saying, this is exactly how I want you to paint my house. This is what time I want you here each day. Do those facts start to change the nature of the relationship?
Yes, absolutely. Not just that particular scenario, but another one I'm thinking of is, say somebody flips houses, and they're hiring somebody to come in and paint all their houses for them. And you know, at some point it changes from really that typical contractor relationship of, this is a painter who I've hired to be as part of my crew, and I'm treating them as an employee. I have that control over them. And so, yes, you're right. That's why we talk about all these factors. And, you know, part of these, when we look at this whole factors, is how dependent is this person on that particular employee for their livelihood versus are they doing this as part of a bigger picture?
Well, I'm glad you said that, because when I look at the test, and I'm also glad about this Supreme Court case, and if you have a name that you can give us for our listeners, we've got some real legal beagles out there, and they'd love to hear the name of that case in a moment. But I'm glad that the Supreme Court came out last year and said that the control factor is not the most important one. It's just one of a number of factors, because to me, it's, you got to look at the context of the situation. So you're saying someone's flipping houses, they bring in a painter to paint their house, to paint the houses that they're flipping. Now, under that scenario, there could, you know, there's like these mini factors. That painter that they're bringing in, what if they have their own employees and they have a UBI and an EIN, even though they're just painting houses for this particular individual that's flipping houses, they still have their own company and they're running it and they're paying their own employees. So that's, you know, one scenario. And another scenario is, what if they, even though they're doing all the, this person who's flipping houses, they're painting all their houses, maybe they're still doing some houses on the side too. Does that change the scenario for you?
Well, and all those factors could change it, but once you have a person who's actually acting as an employer and has a business license, hires people, pays their taxes, it kind of changes the landscape. Because even though there's nothing that says a contractor can't be contracted to just working with a certain business. I mean, we see that in the business world all the time. But it's much different than the person who you bring in to do work for you, and really, the only reason they're not on your payroll is most likely because you don't want to pay all the taxes and stuff that go with that.
Right.
So you call them an independent contractor, but they don't have their own business. They don't or can't do that work on the side. They really are dependent economically on working for this person, just like I'm dependent on Labor and Industries for my paycheck.
And you know, that reminded me, Microsoft and Nintendo seem to have changed. Maybe they got in trouble for this. Maybe there was a class action. Maybe there were complaints. But those entities, I recall, used to bring in contract labor through third parties. And there might have been multiple third parties. So people that would go into work at Nintendo or Microsoft would get hired as an independent contractor because they were placed by some sort of third-party employment agency. But they really were working for Nintendo or Microsoft, and but I guess they were at that time probably being 1099, being paid as independent contractor. That changed. Now it seems that those big entities will pay this third-party employment agency who ends up paying wages to this person that they place at Microsoft Nintendo during the probationary period. Are you familiar with that sort of scenario and how it played itself out in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned janitors earlier. And first of all, no, I'm going to have to apologize to you. I'm terrible with remembering names, and I deal with so many different
no problem.
Court decisions. I probably couldn't. I can't even give you a citation for this case I'll tell you about. But we had a recent case in Washington where it was actually a large chain store hired a contractor to do work to bring in janitors, who hired another contractor, who hired a fourth-level contractor. But what would happen is that fourth-level contractor would bring these janitors into this big-box store. They'd close the store at night, lock the doors, and they couldn't leave until the big-box store let them out in the morning.
Yeah, that sounds like control, doesn't it?
Right. And so, yes, definitely. And so not only was it control, but the interesting thing about that case is it got into another more extensive economic realities test on whether or not businesses are treated as a joint employer. And in that case, they found the big box store was just as liable for the wages as was the small-time contractor. So that kind of changed the whole landscape of how they treat these contractor-subcontractor relationships.
Well, that's a scary thing for employers. And I'm also glad that you raised that, because I saw an example of this on L&I website, and that was in a situation of a contractor hiring a subcontractor. And so the contractor ends up entering into a contract with a number of subcontractors. Usually the generals on the site, and they're overseeing individual jobs that are being done, but these subcontractors performing things like the decking or the painting or the siding, you know, individual particular jobs. And they have their own employees. They have an EIN, they have UBI, and they have their own employees. But sometimes they, as you mentioned, they end up not paying their employees as employees. They pay them under the table. They call them independent contractors. And what L&I wants to do is look back towards the general contractor to say, hey, you have an obligation to have checked your subcontractors to make sure that they're paying wages. But that seems to go in some cases. I know we're trying to protect employees, but doesn't that go a little bit too far sometimes?
Well, and you got to keep in mind, too, that from our standpoint here as the employment standards, we would be looking at the subcontractor most likely as the employer and that they owed the wages. But also those contractors have to register with our contractor registration unit, and their particular laws has what we call that prime contractor liability in it. So if they're going to have that license, a prime contractor then becomes responsible for the debts of their subcontractors. But that's a different law. That's not the one. We would probably be forced to look at the economic realities test as it relates to the sub.
Well, Dave, we just kind of just got to the tip of the iceberg on some of these issues, and there's a lot of examples I wanted to go through. I mean, this topic is a lot sexier than people probably think. I really appreciate you taking the time, both you and Ellen, to join me, Ellen Saline, and Dave Johnson from Department of L&I, to join us on Noah Your Rights on Clay 1180 AM. So thank you again for taking the time to talk about these issues. And
thanks for having us.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And maybe we'll end up having some follow-up information on the website. I'll try to post the cases that you talked about. So thanks again. And listeners out there, thank you for joining us for another edition of Know Your Rights. See you next week, same time, same day.